or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Tucker Mays and Bob Sloan were executives at major corporations like Colgate-Palmolive, Cheeseboro Pond, Miles Laboratories, until they were laid off in their 50s. Each of them found new jobs. They transferred their skills and experience into very different kind of venues. One got into special professional sports, another business-to-business services consulting, sporting goods, even a White House advisory role. And then when that seemed to have dissipated, they organized a networking group for executives in transition. And 5 years later, they decided to hook up with each other and coach other laid-off professionals over 50 to help them find new jobs. And now, they've been doing it for over a decade. And they've written a book on it, Fired at 50, How to Overcome the Greatest Executive Job Search Challenge. I read the book. I read a lot of those kind of books and particularly liked it. Feel that they've got something to share with you guys, whether you're a youngin' or you're an oldin'. So Tucker Mays and Bob Sloan, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be with you.
Good
to be with you, Marty.
Good. So you guys work intensively with a small... I'm hearing some beeping going on. Have we lost you? Are you there?
Yeah, we're here. Sorry.
I heard some beeping that was... Okay. You work very intensively with a small number of clients. You spend about 100 hours per client. That's a lot. It's a lot more than I do. Okay, is this on our end or your end?
No, no.
Are you there?
First time it's happened.
Okay, can you hear us now?
We hear you fine.
All right. What have you learned from all that intensive work about older job seekers that surprised you?
Well, first is that this is Tucker, that they rely on methods that don't work as well for them.
Okay, this is not going to work. Let me see, is this coming from on our end or their end? I need to, we're trying to fix this and see what's going on here.
Okay.
Okay, let's try it again. Okay, I guess we can't do this, so that's amazing. First time in 24 years. Do I need to say goodbye to them, Debbie? Yeah. Guys, I'm sorry. We have obviously, you and I have prepared extensively for this, but there is a technical problem we're having that I don't understand. So, it stopped now. Should we try again?
No. It's coming back on.
Yeah, now we're hearing a bunch of beeps that we've never heard before. One more moment.
Let me just try this with the handset.
Oh, were you using a speakerphone?
Yeah.
As we said, landlines, no speakerphones. Can if we can just have one of you on the air, perhaps then, or have you on regular lines? Because that's not going to work.
Okay.
Are you together now? Are we all right?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
And we, as you know, Marty, we prepared for this, so.
Well, you sound very good now. We're good now. It was your phone system issue. Okay, so let's go. If those are listening. No. All right, guys, we will have to say goodbye. This is not going to work.
Okay, sorry, Marty.
Yeah. My dear listeners, if there's any listeners still listening, this has never happened in 24 years. I don't know what the story is, whether it's a problem with us or their phones. So I'd called them a couple minutes ago, and it all sounded fine. So we will have to ad lib, and therefore that means you, and maybe you'll be the beneficiary. So if you have a question about your work life or someone you love, someone who loves work life, whether it is self-employment or you're employed by others, whether it's you're trying to figure out what you want to be when you grow up, even if you're already 60, the show is going to be, as you know, aimed for people over 50. So
especially if you're an older person. I'd be happy to chat with you about it. I've had more than enough experience myself working with older clients. So let me give you out the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Debbie, what can I do for you? Okay, you want me to try him again? All right. Debbie, you want to call him? Boy, this is really something. Well, the phones are ringing. What can I say? Here we go. Somebody there? Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty and Emco. It's your turn on the air.
Hello, Marty.
Hi.
Hi. I had a question about changing my career.
Sure.
I'm currently a teacher at a private school. I'm 45, mm-hmm. but I'm just about at wit's end, working with children for the last 15 years.
Let's just start just briefly for that to help our listeners. You know, we tend to deify teaching, but almost, I'd say, three-quarters of the teachers that I've met are very frustrated with it. That's why almost half of teachers leave within the first 5 years.
Right.
Paint a real picture about what's making you leave.
Well, I don't think that it's anything out of the ordinary. It's just, you know, every day working, you know, being at the level of the psychology of a child is really difficult. I want to be around, after 15 years, I want to be around adult minds, adult conversations, and, you know, every day having to deal with child-level psychological issues is just, it's kind of grinding on me. I don't think it's anything. You know.
But paint a picture. What are child-level psychological issues?
Well, you know, I mean, you have to explain everything at a very fundamental level. So if there's a fight on the playground, you know, you have to every single time explain, you know, you don't hit other people because you wouldn't want to be hit yourself, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, at first this is, you know, I'm a parent, so I have a 10-year-old son, and, you know, I know how to handle these things, but, you know, it's just not interesting anymore. I have other ideas about how I want to express myself and explore, and, you know, I've pretty much had it with having every day to deal with those kinds of issues.
And by the way, 1 second. Debbie, why don't you come in here? I'm going to give you the phone number. You can try calling. We're going to try. We're going to see if we can get this thing to work. I know the listeners have been interested in hearing this guy talk about what career issues for people over 50. And we're going to see if we can maybe by trying it again. I think maybe we've done something here to fix things. Again, I don't know if the problem was on our end or their end, but what the hell. Okay, so you want to get IT. You want to deal with adults. So... let me ask you a few just fishing expedition questions. So when you were a little kid, what you wanted? Yeah, do you know what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Yeah, I wanted to be a movie director.
Okay. And why? What was that about?
Because whenever I watched films and movies, I just felt that I was totally in my element. That's just how I felt. It was absolutely, you know, that's the thing. That's how you should live life.
Yeah. And is that part of your distant past? Or if we could resurrect it, if I could wave my magic wand that you get to direct films or something like that today, would you be ecstatic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to say is that what I would really like to do is I'd like to become a documentary filmmaker. But I just have no idea how to make the transition from private school education to going into, you know, something that I have no technical training in at all.
Right. Well, here's the, you know, any idiot could tell you that, you know, it's a long odds, don't bother. And it's true, it's ridiculously long odds. But in life, you know, we make choices. We take low-risk choices and high-risk choices. On the highest-risk choice, you quit the darn teaching job, and you go and you learn, you find people who have the technical chops, and you become the, you know, you take a few courses in directing, and you do it low-budget first. You get your chops, so you get a demo, little 3-minute or 5-minute documentary. You send it around, and you relentlessly push until you can actually make a career doing that.
So would this be at like a junior college level?
I hate courses. I absolutely hate courses. I think they're the most inefficient way to learn anything.
Right.
I think what you do is you start by reading articles on directing.
Okay.
I think you start by then reading a book or two written by some of the world's... Maybe my favorite books are assemblages, where it's like each chapter is one director's secret, you know, so what are the secrets to his approach to directing or her director approach to directing? So then having read those, which I could do in like a couple of days, I've now been exposed to the teaching, to the directing techniques of some of the best in the world. I then get my camera out immediately. I get, and you don't need to spend a lot of money. I'd get a, you know, it could be like a 200, it wouldn't be the camera in my phone, but be one step above that. It would be just anything that had a zoom.
So basically just start before you think you're ready.
Absolutely. And you just start making, you know, you create, for me, I would create a, if you didn't have the skills yourself, I'd get a partner to go and create a script or a, you know, I wrote, I know this sounds crazy, but I wrote a basically a scene outline, a synopsis of a play in an hour last night. And in a way, that's the best way to do it. It's organic. I told the story.
Right.
You know? And then you go and you make this 3-minute thing with, and you get your friends to volunteer as actors, and you know, you find some photographer who's got some lighting skills, and you get your feet wet, and you either decide after doing that, you know, I don't want to do that at all,
right?
You know, that is you know, just, it's not as much fun as I fantasized,
uh-huh.
Or I'm crappy at it, or you say, my God, this is what I was meant to do. I'd rather live a life of poverty and do this. Or, no, I'm going to stay in my teaching job, but I'm going to do this on the side of a serious hobby. I'm not going to go and watch TV. I'm not going to go and go to my cousin's bar mitzvah in Topeka. I am going to spend every waking spare minute doing film. Now, that's my little brain dump. What's your reaction to any of that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I just, you know, I've had those same thoughts myself, and I've listened to your show for quite a while, so I think intuitively I knew that that's what you're going to say. I just really don't know how to make the first practical step. I mean, it seems like what you're saying, I should basically go out and get a book and read as much as possible.
No, kiddo, I want you to get off the phone right now, and I want you to Google the term movie directing and read the article. Google I am so, you know, in love with Google.
Right.
Their algorithm is so amazing. So that usually among the first two or three or four hit listings that you come up with after a Google search, it's one of those is going to be great.
Right.
Just read those. It costs you Zippo. Right now, with your cup of coffee, get off, read that. Then after you've read maybe 3-4 articles, go to Amazon and search on the term movie directing. Order the book. Order it used. It'll cost you next to nothing.
Uh-huh.
But find the book that, as I said, my favorite are those that are not written by a whole book, but written by one director. But there's going to be a book, something like 30 movie directors share their secrets.
Right.
That's what you want.
Anthology.
And can you see within like a couple of days, you know a lot already,
right.
And then get the camera out.
Okay, I'm on it.
All right. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Okay, I got good news, or I have good news. I'm being informal. We hopefully will have our guests back, but I'm having fun answering these questions for you. I hope that you will. You're getting something out of this too. And you can see it's not planned radio, but at least it's authentic. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Good morning. Love the show, Marty. First, a quick observation. That strange tone that came on instead of your guest reminded me immediately of that federal response system.
Yeah, right.
When the weather's getting bad, and I looked out and I thought, wow, overcast, but no tornado. What is going on? And perhaps you might be using a specific phone line that's reserved for that use.
No,
but,
it's their problem. It's...
I giggled when you said, what do you want to be when you grow up when you're over 50? And I just joined that club.
Exactly.
I'm not unhappy with what I do, a lot with the regulations that are imposed for the outside, but I've always wanted to indulge more in my artistic side,
right,
rather than just going to museums and buying art.
Yeah.
But I would like your advice about how to turn off the inner critic.
You want to keep it on. I think that's typical Bay Area psychobabble crap.
Well,
turn off the
stifling.
Inner critic.
I know. I get halfway through doing a collage, and I think, oh, this isn't very good.
Oh, here we go. We got more problems. Okay. What I'm encouraging you to do is, I want you to be a critic, but accept, you can be a critic without it stifling you. I want you to say
that's the point I want to get to.
Right. I want you to say, that's crap. That's a piece of crap. I'm ripping that crap up, and I'm starting again. That's absolutely fine. It is what we want to quell is, that's crap. I'm giving up. I'm going to go smoke a joint. That's what we're trying to get rid of. Are you there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, every winner, every successful person has failed more times than they've succeeded. And so your work probably does suck right now. You're trying to make a transition. It probably does suck. So keep saying, this sucks, until something doesn't suck. Even if it's not a whole piece of artwork, even if it's one corner of a piece of artwork, you say, okay, that's a nugget. You know, it's corny, but persistence really does matter. Does this make sense?
Yeah, I'd like to find something I can tell myself to just push on doing it, as opposed to, I think that this sucks, inner thinking, just gets me to stop completely.
But that's what I'm at the risk of repeating myself. You must be able to say that sucks. Mm-hmm. There are so many people who say, oh, that's good. That's really good. You know, and then they never get better. Mm-hmm. The successful people are incredibly hard on themselves. They do say this sucks every time until it doesn't. Or if it sucks for too long, then you say, this is not what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to go to. It is a gross mistake, a gross mistake to try to turn off your inner critic. Every successful person I know is extremely hard on themselves. The difference is they don't give up. They say, this sucks. How can I make it better? And if they can't make it better by themselves, they get a tutor. A tutor who would be the artist whose genre you most respect and who has a personality that you like and who doesn't just say, it sucks, but why don't you try this?
Mm-hmm.
That's the key. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense as in sign up for a class and do the assignments.
A class? Yes. Some people need the social of the class, as I said to the previous caller.
The feedback.
I believe the one-on-one. The class is bad. Because you're only getting a very small percentage of the time of that instructor that's individualized. And the feedback you can get from your fellow peers is going to be too much input. I'd rather see you get less high-quality input than more low-quality. Find the artist the artist who's local, whose work makes you excited, whose style is similar to yours, and sit down with them. Once a week, twice a week, for a half hour. It doesn't have to be a long, drawn-out affair. Get feedback and keep working. Dude, I want you to be a tough critic, but I don't want the... It's what counts is the moment after you've criticized. It's the moment after this sucks. Not that it sucks. It's saying, okay, it sucks. I'm going to make it better. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. My best shot.
Thanks.
Take care. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Namco. Your turn on the air. Hello. Hi, you're on work. You're on Work with Marty Nemko, and I'm answering your questions. How can I help?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I'm not calling for the makeup. I'm calling for the encouragement. I'm really enjoying the excitement of radio that works sometimes and doesn't work other times. This is great. Just giving you feedback. I hope I'm not too positive. I know you like to be hard on yourself, but this is very interesting.
Thanks.
And your woman there, trying to figure out the mystery. This is not a test. Warning signal.
Right.
Go for it. And I'm looking forward to working out the kinks and hearing their program. I think it'll happen.
Well, thanks a lot for the call.
All right. Bye.
I appreciate it. We don't have a guy on the phone yet. Do we? Our guests. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I want to know, I don't know if it's a business partner per se that I need. I'll tell you my problem.
Yep.
I am an artist designer in San Francisco, and a couple years ago I started a business. I make women's accessories from repurposed materials.
Right.
I also have a part-time job at the library, which pays the bill, so to speak. And I do everything myself. I design, make things, sell them, find stores around the country. And I've yet to turn a profit. My problem is that although my things have been, you know, when I call a place, like I Google, you know, Eco Boutiques in New York, and I find some places, and the response has been great, and I've gotten them in a lot of places. My problem is I'm, this sounds kind of funny, but it's a certain kind of loneliness. It's like,
sure.
And what I need, at first I thought I needed a business partner, but, you know, a couple of friends, and I have people helping me, by the way, a lifelong friend actually does my website for me and, you know, different things. It's not that I don't have help, but I need someone to kind of get together with, maybe like, I don't know, three times a week and, you know, kind of brainstorm, like you sit down together, okay, what should we do today? You know, that type of thing. Because sometimes what's happened really recently, for instance, I was supposed to deliver some things to this store in the Castro that's supposed to do a whole window of my stuff, and I just haven't been able to get it together. And I wake up, and I just doing everything myself sometimes is overwhelming.
Yep.
So I thought of putting like a post. I mean, I know this isn't the answer, but almost like a post on Craigslist. You know, I don't think business partner, but I don't know what. Anyway, okay. That's my conundrum.
Here's the deal. That's a really, really common problem. And to be honest, it occurs 10 times as much with women as it does with men. Women do like connection. Women like bonding. Women like, they don't like to be isolated. Guys can sit in front of their computers and program all day. Women don't do that in general. There's exceptions. And so here are the various options. And tell me, you know, what goes on. You don't, you, a partner is always dangerous because then you're really sharing decision making and it becomes fighting and it's horrible. But if you hire somebody to come in 3 times a week to do some of the crap work you don't like to do, the cold calling, the record keeping, the cleaning, maybe helping assembling, maybe some of the jewelry making that after a while gets boring. It's the packaging, it's whatever, but getting somebody to come in a few times a week to do that stuff both gets more work done, that frees you up to do the higher level work and gets you company. And it shouldn't be a Craigslist ad. Usually most likely to be successful is you choose a friend. Somebody who you really like, who could use some extra money, and you don't have to pay them a lot of money. This sounds like $10 an hour work or $12 an hour work, and do that. The other option is sometimes people's loneliness is because they don't have romance. They don't have love in their life. And so it's not so much that they need the partner there, but they need love in their life. So they
in
need
that particular case, that's not the case in this case, although that does make sense, and I could see how it could be transferred.
Right. So what do you think about that idea of getting somebody, you know, making a list of all the things that not only need to be done, but that could be done to improve your business, and then get one of your friends rather than a Craigslist ad? Because believe me, the wrong hire can make your life crazy and make you.
I actually don't know someone. There was someone who I saw about a year ago, you know, we tried a couple things, and he didn't have the skill set that I thought, you know. And I actually don't know someone who would fit that bill.
Okay. Now, I want to look for what Seth Godin calls tribes. What do you belong to? A church? Do you belong to a volunteer organization? Do you belong to some kind of, because clearly you're into ecology, ecological related stuff, you know, into a sustainable living organization of some sort? What tribes do you belong to?
I do not. I don't belong to anything at all. As a matter of fact, I don't belong to anything at all. But you know, as we speak, I have something posted up. Someone told me about, it's something called Stitch 'em Bitch, and it's a group of women that get together Friday nights.
Perfect.
And to just kind of like,
perfect,
you know, just like kind of hang out and work on their own individual stuff.
Right.
So I know that those type of course, I'd have to, I realize this next thing I'm going to say, though, is the constant thing of how you always put up like, oh, I can't do this because what I was going to say is, you know, I have to kind of bring all my things over there, and it seems kind of not.
Don't bring all things out. You know what? Dr. Nemko, this is the prescription for you.
Okay.
I want you to go to 3 different such meetings. I love Stitch 'em Bitch is perfect. You know, I actually knew a group of bookbinders, old-fashioned handmade bookbinders, women, who got together and they did their bookbinding by themselves. Don't bring all your stuff. Bring something simple. Go show up one time at a meeting.
More just for the social thing.
Yeah.
At first.
And then go to 3 of them and see if you find a person with whom you chemically click, and let it, and maybe even at the meeting, let it be known that that's what you're looking for. I guarantee you, nobody's going to be surprised that you would like to have somebody around.
That's a good idea, because I was thinking how I had to kind of like drag all my stuff over there and like madly make things. But I see your point. Good
idea.
Keep
it simple. You know, keep it simple. The key is to act. The key is to not ruminate, to act. All right. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
All right, and now, let us all, whatever your religious tradition, praying to God, to Muhammad, whatever you are praying to. Muhammad is not somebody you pray to. I guess Allah you pray to. Muhammad is the preacher. Let's go. We've got our guests. Let's set this up again. There are these two guys who were corporate executive types who got laid off, and a lot of stuff happened, and they ended up, for the last decade, they've been coaching other people who are laid off in their 50s, which to try to get a job, which ain't easy. They wrote a book called Fired at 50, quote, subtitled How to Overcome the Greatest Executive Job Search Challenge. Read the book. Book's interesting. And so I will have them on the show today, except we had like what seems to be like national civil defense air raid siren sounds from their line that couldn't work. So they have gone and frantically moved to another location. And we all hope, pray, whatever, that there are no weird beeps, but that we indeed have Tucker Mays and Bob Sloan. Do we?
Hello again, Marty. Bob and Tucker, glad to be on again.
Well, let's give it a shot. Let's start at the beginning. So You've worked with a pretty small number of clients, but you spend 100 hours per client. What have you learned about older job seekers that has surprised you?
Well, small number of clients at any one time, and we've worked hundreds over the last 11 years.
Okay.
Surprises are that they rely on methods that don't work as effectively when they're over 50, like recruiters, known contacts, and published job leads. Surprising to them, those are far less effective after 50. Also, they generally have unrealistic job goals. As Marshall Goldsmith famously said, what got you here won't necessarily get you there. They have to think about where they are needed now, and generally that's not with the larger companies they came from. Another surprise is...
Hold on, let me go. Let's take them one at a time here. So I'm actually surprised. I mean, you know, a lot of headhunters, executive recruiters, they do recruit. I would, you know, they do hire. You know, there are many CEOs and C-level people who are over 50. Why would recruiters not be interested?
It's not that they're interested. It's the first point is that recruiters account for less than 10% of
sure.
all jobs gained out there.
Sure. You know, you are cutting out again. I don't know what it is. You know,
let's try this.
You know what? I'm going to make an executive order. I want to have one of you on the phone. I want not both of you on the phone. I want the one of you who's got a better phone connection. The person who's just talking now has got a good connection. Other guy, off the phone, please.
We are at the same location, and it's Tucker on the phone. There's a little echo. But in any case, let's try this.
Yeah, Tucker, you're good. I want to stay with you. You're going to be my guy.
Okay. Recruiters account for less than 10% of all job leads, and most executives spend almost half their time relying on recruiters they know. Most individuals, when they reach 50, rely again on people they know that they went to college with, they worked with, and they hardly ever know of jobs. As a matter of fact, it's people that they don't know that their contacts do know where you'll find the jobs. And lastly, they rely on published job leads. And the reason they can't do that is that thousands of people
right.
look at those job leads on Monster.com
right.
or the Ladders or the Wall Street Journal, and the competition is huge.
Right. So, Tucker, so that's the – right. So people know you got to get a job through a network, but your existing network usually is not good enough. How does somebody at after age 50 build a network quickly enough – that they will be likely to be a large enough group and care enough about you that they're willing to go to the mat for you and say, I don't care if this guy is unemployed. I don't care if he's 58 years old. I'm going to go and fight for this guy to help him get a job. How do you do that in a reasonable amount of time without, you know, what happens is these guys in their 50s, they got mortgages. They have children in college. They can't afford to take a year or 2 years to build deep connections. How do they build connections quickly enough that that'll actually help them get a job?
Marty, this is Bob. You know, essentially the most important thing to keep in mind is that there are so many companies out there. You only need one job, and one inevitably needs you. How you get to those kinds of opportunities that make sense really begins by having a very, very precise focus.
Yeah.
This is one of the other surprises we learned early on. People do not get focused fast enough.
Yep.
Okay, and the beginning of effective, proactive, networking-driven job search is to have a very clear objective that differentiates you in terms of your special skills versus other candidates. And when you start with that as your opening premise, the networking will work better. You use that as a basis to have people refer you to others who you've never met before. Because inevitably, people you've never met before, that's really where the jobs are.
Got it. Let me flesh that out. I understand, dear listeners, that you know very well that you could do 56,000 different kinds of jobs. There isn't one narrow thing you could do. But humankind is very frail. They are very narrow. They don't want to be bothered. Hiring is something, and referring people for a job lead is something that is an ancillary part of their life. So they need to put you in a little box. Because if you say, I can do this, 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 and this, it's overwhelming. So to accommodate to the frailty of the human condition, you got to pick something. You got to say, I am a VP-level person who works very well in mid-sized companies in medical software. And have specific expertise in supply chain management or whatever. Unless you're that specific, you're just going to feel like a generalist, and nobody wants to hire a generalist unless you're that close with them. You're sleeping with them, then they'll hire you for anything. But other than that, you've got to be that specific. Is that a fair summary?
That's absolutely correct. It is extremely hard for people to do that, because there are less jobs out there. They want to throw a wide net and not miss out anything.
Yep.
But as Goethe famously said 150 years ago, at the moment of commitment, the universe conspires to assist you.
Yeah.
That is true in job search. The tighter the focus, the faster you find your job.
It's true. So let's say I've defined myself. Like, I'm thinking about a typical Bay Area executive who's let go. So the guy has been a product manager at a VP level or manager level for a software company, for some high tech company that makes a chip or makes a circuit board or makes a remote, mobile thing. What does he do now, or she, of course? What do they do with that? Walk me through if I were your client and I said that, okay, you've convinced me. I am going to be very narrowly focused. All I care about is I'm going to care about biomedical software here in the Valley, and I am a product manager. That's who I am, and that's what I want. Now what do I do?
What you got to do, and this is Bob again, you have to differentiate yourself from so many other product managers in the software space. And it means bearing down and learning and identifying what are the key skills and talents that set you apart. And this is the beginning of a process of differentiation. And it's classic marketing. And there are going to be many, many people competing for the same job, some of whom are working and have that advantage of being coaxed out of existing jobs and not in transition. Each individual has a very, very special set of skills that will set them apart. Not everybody has all the same skills. You know, we often advise clients who have resumes that list, 30 skills, because they want to tack in with everybody's keywords. Well, that's very counterproductive, because nobody is good at 30 skills.
But what do we do with the problem product management, as example, most of these executive jobs, and this can apply to the nonprofit sector as well, they require the same. They require you to have good budgeting skills. You have to have good, project timeline software skills. You have to have people management skills. You have to understand the technology and the bio. We talked about biomed. You've got to understand that. You need those skills, and that's what everybody's got. If you identify some little narrow skill, is that really going to be the thing that's going to put you over the top?
Well, yeah, and what you have to do, first you must understand that when it goes into interview process, they'll get down to three individuals, and all of you will basically have the same abilities and experience, or you wouldn't have gotten that far, and you'll be a pretty good fit. What it comes down to, it is what we call a talent that you have versus a skill. And talent is something that you've developed yourself over time that really is unique and is endemic to you. You've got to find that out and really push that and make sure that it's a key at the company. For example, you might take on challenges that others avoid. You may, in fact, work exceptionally well with cross-functional teams, which are very political, and you're good at that. You may, in fact, be very good at planning through a process and not so much in the creative part. So you have to find what distinguishes you from others, because invariably in the interview, it comes down to, look, I've got two other people as good as you, Tucker. Why should I hire you? And that answer usually gets you the job.
I fear we've jumped ahead, though, around the dirty question that we've kind of skirted. You said, focus, that's all well and good. But the reality is, if in fact what's going to help you get a job is what you said, and it is true, it is really good, powerful connections that you don't already have going in. My question, which has kind of been skirted around, is how do you build those connections fast enough before you go and lose your home? Your kid has to drop out of college because you don't have any money in it. That takes usually months or years. How do you, with reasonable alacrity, with reasonable speed, how does one build a deep and broad enough network?
Great question, Bob again, Marty. Essentially, it's all about the gold standard in networking. As Tucker said earlier, it's getting to people you don't know.
How?
By starting with the people you do know and then beginning the process of one at a time getting referrals to those who you have never met before. And that's essentially how it works. Now, here's a surprising thing. Most people wouldn't think about this. Mostly the people you know best are often not ones who can help you the most in a job search.
Right.
They're usually not the ones who know about jobs. Contacts you're meeting for the first time, it's a blank piece of paper. You are presenting yourself in the way that you want to be presented. They're not hung up with what they thought of you 5-10 years ago. They're not up to the contacts who know you best are not necessarily up to date on what you've become or even what you're seeking now, back to the importance of having a clear job objective. And this happens time and time again, and people tell us this. We see it in our clients. They get jobs from people they've never met before. And if that's the gold standard, you just have to develop the art of presenting yourself well, not wasting people's time, taking no more than 30 minutes in a networking call, and making sure it's clear that you know what you want and you don't expect them to tell you. And the better you do at presenting yourself, the better you'll get referrals. Have a target contact list. Know exactly where you want to go and who you want to meet. Have people react to that. Don't let them have to figure it out for you.
If, you know, people, my clients are telling me all the time, it's well and good. They have a heck of a time even finding the names of the right people that they don't know that are powerful enough. They can't get through on the phone call. They can't get 30 minutes with them. And if they got 30 minutes with them, even if they are Jesus incarnate and they're doing a great job of presenting a very tightly focused goal, you know, it's very hard in a few minutes to create enough of an emotional connection that person is going to go to the mat for that stranger and help him get a job. What am I missing here?
What you may be missing is that you can't accomplish everything at once. You can't be talking to a networking contact about having a job for you or even knowing about a job. The key to networking effectiveness is once you present yourself and present what you're looking for with a smart target list is to ask for perspective and advice. And you never ask the person for a job, you never expect them to have a job. And quite often what happens if you present yourself well, jobs happen. That is, you're talking to somebody, you haven't told them you expect that they're going to have a job for you, but you've been well referred, and that's the key. This is not a cold call. It's a warm, cool call. It's all based upon the power of a personal referral.
Let me ask you this. You know, in your book, you say that you need to make 100 new contacts a month. That is a daunting number for all but great, great networkers who loved it. And if they were great networkers, they probably wouldn't need job hunting help. How do you help the typical job hunter, somebody who has been who's in their 50s and has spent most of the time doing their job, trying to be good at their job, to say, okay, I am now going to become a networker. I'm going to make 100 new contacts a month.
Well, first of all, it starts with how much time, this is Tucker, spending on networking. If 80% of all jobs are gained that way, you spend, 80% of the full day in job search on networking. That's 6 hours a day. The benchmark is to contact 5 new people per day and meet with or conduct a networking meeting on the phone with 5 per week. How do you do that? You start with 25, 30, 35 people you know from various places in work, or as we said earlier, in college, etc. Most people can do that. You talk to those people. You tell them what you're interested in. You tell them your job objective, the skills that you have, where you're looking, and you ask them, could you introduce me to some people that you may know in my industry of interest? Because I would like to get their feedback on, are my current skills the most relevant in the industry today? What are the latest needs that are in that particular industry? I want to learn more and make sure that my search is right on target. You never ask them for a job, yep. Puts pressure on them, and they rarely know of one. They introduce you, on average, to 2 or 3. You can see how that builds. So the person you know introduces you to someone else. And that individual, because of the referral, is interested in talking to you.
Let me interrupt you. Let me beg you for absolute honesty. I've been a career coach to 3,900 people.
Sure.
People say that I'm really good at what I do. And in the theory you say sounds great. But in the trenches where I'm working, and maybe either I'm an inferior career coach or maybe my clients are inferior, but they're not. I have very senior clients. They can't get five conversations a day with anybody important at all. They're grateful if they come back and have had two good ones in a week. They no matter how many times I tell them that they need to spend 35 hours a week on this and they need to be using, you know, dissimilar. I am not getting my clients to be very compliant at that, most of them. Are you really, are a high percentage of your clients really putting in, able to get five conversations with information interviews a day with people?
No, I never said five per day, Marty. There must have been a miscommunication.
I must have heard.
I said that they need to have five of those good networking conversations a week,
a week. Okay.
They need to reach out to five a day.
I see.
You're spending 6 hours a day doing this, you should be able to do that. Our clients do. The benchmark for successful job search to find a job in 8 months or less, which our clients do, versus a year to a year and a half on norm, is they eventually reach out to close to 1,000 new contacts. Now, LinkedIn has helped them do that.
Yep.
LinkedIn in 45 days should get you an additional 300. And I would say that LinkedIn, if it's done well, account for well over 600 of those 900 to 1,000 in a year.
Isn't it crazy? Isn't this crazy that it should require this much work? Now, I'm not talking about practically. I'm talking from a larger meta sense here. Isn't it crazy that it should take this much work to land a job? There's something crazy about this country. There's something frightening, actually, that it should take 1,000 contacts trying to beg your way into a job to get one job. Isn't this, there's something fundamental wrong here.
Well, networking has for years been, this is Tucker again, the number one way to get a job. It's just harder now. So you need to reach more. Fortunately, through blogging and LinkedIn, et cetera, there are ways to accelerate that process. And, of course, the other thing is how well you do it. Most of people abuse the networking process, ask for a job, turn people off, et cetera, et cetera. But make no bones about it. It's, you don't become a great football player unless you do two-a-days and kill yourself in the summer. And the blocking and tackling, even as executives making $100,000 or a year or more, is you have to do the blocking and tackling. And those who don't take forever to find a job. That's just where it is.
Yeah, it is. It is really tough. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guests are Tucker Mays and Bob Sloan. They are the authors of Fired at 50. The website is firedat50spelledout.com. Let's turn to once you've got the guy on the phone. It is critical that you have a good exit story. In other words, if you're so great, why the hell are you looking? So let's be real here. If you're let go for the most common reason, the reason you're let go as an executive, it could be, you know, racism, sexism, homophobia, ageism, all that. But, you know, more often it is because the organization feels they can find somebody better than you. You're not the worst, but they've got somebody younger, cheaper, better. And so if that's the truth about why you got let go, what kind of an exit story can you tell that's honest?
It's a really good question, Marty. This is Bob again. When you're let go at a senior level, very, very often, it is because of a corporate downsizing or because of a reorganization. I mean, when industry consolidating and companies basically shrinking, whether it's because of outsourcing, I mean, these jobs are disappearing and they're not all coming back. Now, on the other hand, when you're let go at an executive level, one of the things that it is advisable to do, and most companies will assist their executives this way, is to come up with a commonly agreeable exit story. It is a fundamental thing that, again, at a senior executive level, most companies are willing to do. And it's usually put into the hands of the terminated executive to say, you know, you tell us what you would like to say and in a way that we would support it. That's essentially what happens. And, yes, you're absolutely right. In many cases, they're gonna go to a less expensive, more junior person, and that's all part of what's commonly referred to in the world as, you know, restructuring. It is really necessary to put your exit into the most favorable light.
Again, I'm stepping back.
Most companies will agree with that, as long as it's, you know, within the realm of what's realistic.
You know, I'm stepping back and looking at this just from a societal point of view. You know, America has become the land of BS. You know, the truth gets obfuscated in exit stories, as you say. Well, there's some kind of story that's going to be agreed to that the person who's getting fired or laid off is going to craft, and they'll agree to it as part of the severance package to avoid a lawsuit. And so you've got, you know, in exit stories, in resumes, in cover letters, in interviews, you have this massive amount of BS and a minimum amount of truth that is getting presented in the world. Is there something that is, again, fundamentally crazy about the fact that you have to contact 1,000 people to get a job and you got to BS to get a job? There's something wrong here.
Well, I would never term it as BS. I just wouldn't.
Well, you just said the guy concocts a story that both.
No,
both...
he can position the story in a way that he thinks is realistic and the company will support.
Okay.
And again, it may very well be that the company is essentially trying to get, you know, different kind of talent. That's understandable, but I don't think it's something that the individual job seeker has to dwell on.
True. That's certainly true. You know, I know that, of course, every employer knows that when there is a, quote, restructuring or a downsizing, those people are not downsized at random. Companies take enormous care. They hire Accenture as a consultant to come in and say which are the employees who are providing the least value per dollar. And they let go. Well, there's exceptions. But they generally restructure or lay off the least valuable employees. By definition, I mean, nobody is stupid. They're not, companies are not stupid. They're not going to lay off the most valuable people. So how does a job seeker counter what is the unvarnished truth? That they may not say it, but employers know in their heart of hearts, this guy was laid off. And that's why so many companies have a policy. I'm not hiring anybody who's unemployed, because my chances are better of getting a good person, of getting somebody who's currently employed. How does a job seeker counter that?
Well, you're making assumptions which, with all due respect, we're not finding are the major reasons that are out there. In reorganizations or in restructures, I'll just use my own example, Marty. When I was out in California, I turned a company around, made a lot of money for them, and my company was purchased. The acquiring company already had a COO. So I was made redundant, as they say in England. No fault of my own. I had no problem explaining that and becoming president again. Reorganizations often occur because they're going in the wrong direction and they're losing money, and they want to go in a new direction, and they bring in new people who have different skills. You are doing your best. You may have done well where you're going, but it wasn't the right direction of the company. And you can rationalize that the company made decision to go in a new direction and your skills didn't apply. So there are an awful lot of reasons. And again, the key thing for everybody to know is it's not what happened to you in your career, which is important. It's how you talk about what happened. And I think I've just given two reasons and two ways that they can finesse the notion, in many cases, of why they were let go. In fact, all the clients we have, it is very rare that they were let go because they weren't qualified, they didn't do the job.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to another thing. Now, we talked about two or three times about companies will very often hire a more junior person because they're cheaper. Now, if truth be told, isn't it wiser for employers, all things being equal, to give preference to younger candidates? Sure, older workers have the benefit of experience, absolutely. But younger workers usually cost less. They have more energy on average. They are less set in their ways on average because they haven't had 30 or 40 years to acquire one particular way of doing things. They are, on average, more technologically current. They are less likely to be bitter. There's a heck of, you know, many of my clients who are in their 50s and have been laid off after they've killed themselves for the company or the nonprofit, or the, you know, they are more likely to be bitter. And, of course, younger people are more willing to pull an all-nighter. And they're less likely to acquire a disease that's covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, like cancer or heart attack, stroke, diabetes. And one more thing, they're not like people over 40, they're not in a protected class. So if the employer feels they want to get rid of him, the employer can terminate him with less risk of a lawsuit. Are employers really wrong in thinking that they're, in general, wise to give, even if those are illegal, I know that, but, you know, is it not wise on average for employers to think that they'd be wiser to hire younger people?
I don't think it's necessarily wise as a general statement because, as a matter of fact, there's a shift, and you may have read about it, to hiring older people. It just happened in the last few months in America for a variety of reasons. It also depends, Marty, on where they're looking. For example, smaller companies put a higher value on wisdom and experience for individuals that they want to hire from the outside to come into their smaller company and coach and accelerate the growth of those younger people who are in the company. We recommend that our clients and to your listeners focus on companies that are under 100 million in sales. There are 20 times as many companies in America under 100 million in revenue as there are above. And those companies are far less in the box on the many things that you fairly recommend are reasons not to hire someone over 50. We have found that the health risks don't materially change that much from 40s to 50s. And we also find that in many cases, the key skills that individuals gain as they get to their 50s in problem solving, people management, judgment and leadership far outweigh some of the risks that they are a little bit older. They, in fact, because they've seen more problems, hired and fired more people, know when to hire, when to fire, who to keep a lot better than those who are less experienced. And they're able to solve problems faster, which is in such demand, because they've seen more of them. They identify them faster and know the solutions that work best.
Let's go to the phones and see if we can take a question or two for you. Dear listeners, if you are a person over 50 who either has been laid off and would like to talk with the authors of Fired at 50, How to Overcome the Greatest Executive Job Search Challenge, I invite you to call. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Either a question for them, or if you want to tell your story, success story, or failure story, welcome hearing from you. You mentioned correctly that most hiring of good jobs is not done by little startups. That those tend to be, you know, you get paid in stock, and most of those go out of business. But you talked about the mid-sized companies, not the Fortune 500s. How does someone go about finding those mid-sized companies that would be in hiring mode?
It's a challenge for many, but there are many ways to do it. We always say that the best place to conduct your job search is at the library, your local library, the business reference. There are a host of books that are available and online services, usually provided free. Reference USA, for one, leaps to mind as a place to identify smaller companies in your area, your state, or your region. There is the Million Dollar Directory, which is famous for identifying smaller emerging companies. There are many ways that you can do that through your library to identify them. Hoover's, you can identify the presidents of smaller companies through CEO Go or Zoom Info, Z-O-O-M Info. Lots of places you can go to identify these companies.
Sounds good. Thanks for that. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with my guests Bob Sloan and Tucker Mays, the co-authors of Fired at 50. What's on your mind? Hello.
We're here. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. Just fine.
Well, great. Marty, I just wanted to preface my remarks. I was introduced to you on a major commercial network, and it was great hearing you, and I'm so delighted to reconnect.
Thank you. My pleasure to have you joining me here. What's on your mind?
So my anecdote is as follows. I was fired from a legal job as a legal secretary, and I'm over 50, and I came across a book called The Legal Job Interview, and it had what for me was a revolutionary concept in seeking employment, and that was basically to say as little as possible. I know that is counterintuitive in, you know, we're trained to sell ourselves. But the hiring, the person that's hiring is trying to manage risk that they're going to hire the wrong person. So the more you say, you know, the more opportunities they're going to have to strike you. I used that strategy, and I found a job rather quickly, and I think that that had a substantial amount to do with it. When you're a new employee, they want somebody who will fit in, who will not always speak as if they know everything, who knows how to take directions and get with the program. After you've been with the firm a couple of years, then you're more free to speak up. And I just wanted to share that for me, that was really instrumental in being fired at 50, using that strategy, and now being really gainfully employed at a raise and really satisfied with my working relationship.
Good point. I appreciate the call. That's straight out of How to Win Friends and Influence People. Talk less, listen more. It certainly is the truth. So I want to listen more. We've only got a couple of minutes, so I want to give you a chance, either Tucker or Bob. What's one? Let's talk a little bit about it. You talked about LinkedIn briefly. I mean, LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, these are all tools that can be of help. What's one non-obvious tip that you have for us on how to use either Facebook or LinkedIn? What's your real nugget that you've got that's not obvious?
It's a great question. There is so much that's being written about social media. Biggest challenge that people have in job search is not to spend too much time in it, and realize that there are only a very few of these kind of techniques that make sense for job search. LinkedIn is vitally important for all the reasons we
how
know.
What I want we all have a LinkedIn. Let me finish. We all have a LinkedIn profile. We've got our references. We've got our profile. But now we want to go beyond that.
Right.
You know, that's 2006. Everybody was doing that in 2006, 2008. Now it's 2012. The job market is much tougher. 2011. Job market is much tougher. What's a non-obvious tip on how to use LinkedIn to make you a cut above the 1,000 other applicants for the jobs?
Well, first of all, there's two ways that LinkedIn is important. One, because you want to be found. You know that. The other very important reason is that you want to use it as a way of proactively getting introductions and referrals to your target contacts. And as we said earlier, you got to have a target contact list to make a job search work. And when you go on LinkedIn, you will find, after probably a lot of process of elimination, who is your LinkedIn path of connections to your target contacts or others in their same companies. So that's really a key to LinkedIn. And it's going back to what we said earlier about how it as a tool can actually accelerate the number of new contacts you make.
Okay. My guests have been Tucker Mays and Bob Sloan. They are the authors of Fired at 50. They have a website which talks about their consultancy, Fired at 50, spell it out, 50FIFTY.com. The book is it's a very simple, quick read. It is a good basic primer of what really does work. There's no magic answers here, dudes. You know, one of the things, dear listeners, I don't mean dudes, you might guess, I'm talking about listeners. In the end, is it fair to say it really does come down to you've got to develop new contacts and you've got to make a lot of them and you've got to be very crisp in your pitch? Does it come down to that?
Sure does.
Okay. Thanks again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. And that is the show for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. No guest. A whole hour of your calls. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on anybody who dares call me, and I'll intersperse those with my favorite new ideas on how to help your career. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
More than 500 of Marty Nemco's published articles and chapters from his book, Cool Careers for Dummies, are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or want to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com, that's martynemko.com. Join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco, right here on 91.7 KLW, San Francisco.